This week on Making Contact,
representatives of Monsanto come into the village. They give away the seeds for free. They'll often give them marketing materials that are done in the same colors of the Indian flag.
If we would begin to clean up the way that we produce our food and not let our food policy be driven by corporations that are most concerned about their profit, we could address a lot of the problems around terrorism in our food supply.
21st century high technology has not abated hunger in many parts of the world. Pesticides and industrialized processing deplete needed nutrients, doing more harm than good. On this program, we take a look at the role multinational corporations play in perpetuating the cycle of hunger. We also hear how so-called free trade and food aid contributes to starvation. I'm Shereen Marisol Meraji, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. The right to feed oneself, either through tilling the land or through adequate pay for work, was enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by 145 countries in 1976. Yet over 800 million people around the world lack that basic right and go to sleep hungry. Even industrialized countries have not solved the problem of hunger. In the United States, over 40 million people live below the official poverty line, the number one cause of hunger. How can this be? There's enough food to go around in the world. Many organizations working to eradicate hunger place most of the blame on industrialized agriculture and on policies of global financial institutions such as the World Bank, which recommends replacing traditional models of farming with a resource-intensive industrial model that usually involves the use of pesticides, genetically modified seeds, and single crops instead of a diversity. They also push for a model based on export, which destroys communities' self-sufficiency. Correspondent Diane Solomon has more.
According to a report issued by the International Forum on Globalization, entitled, Does Globalization Help the Poor?, almost all evidence shows the opposite is happening. Poverty and inequality are rapidly accelerating everywhere on Earth. Is economic globalization actually increasing food scarcity and hunger in developing nations? Debbie Barker, co-director of the International Forum on Globalization, quoting a report issued by the United Nations, answers.
Specifically, if you're talking about hunger, we do know this. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, in their 1998 report, The State of Food and Agriculture, says the number of chronic people in the world has increased since the early 1990s after steadily decreasing the two previous decades. It says this is mainly because there's been little progress in reducing poverty. The widening gap in income distribution in many parts of the world is also a worrying trend for undernourishment.
In fact, the World Bank itself said in a 1999 report that globalization appears to increase poverty and inequality. One of the most traumatic impacts of globalization in terms of poverty and hunger creation has come with the forced shift of local economies away from small-scale diversified crop farms to an export-oriented model. Under International Monetary Fund, World Bank, and World Trade Organization mandates, the governments of developing nations are told to eliminate subsidies to their farmers. Suddenly, without government support, the farmers, needing new sources of income, are vulnerable to high-pressure sales tactics from transnational corporations. Debbie Barker describes how farmers are coerced into switching from growing self-sustaining food crops to competing in a worldwide commodities market where prices have plummeted.
I was in a meeting in Hungary just a while ago, and a woman from the IMF said, you know, after I gave a presentation about the hunger in many developing countries, and she said, you know, you make it sound as though these corporations are forcing these genetically modified seeds on farmers and that we're forcing our chemical industrial system on them, when my understanding is that farmers are actually swimming, you know, rivers and crossing mountains to get to the corporations and begging for these miracle seeds and these miracle chemicals. And I said, well, that's not really what's happening. I've been to small villages in India where representatives of Monsanto come into the village. They, first of all, give away the seeds for free. They'll often give them marketing materials that are done in the same colors of the flag, of the Indian flag. So the farmers think that this is kind of a government-sponsored program. They'll start by giving them the chemicals and fertilizers for free. And then, of course, later, when the farmers get kind of hooked on it and converted everything, then they start charging them, you know, for things. Well, this is being forced upon people, if you will, and people are not really swimming oceans and rivers and begging the corporations for help.
Hunger increases when people who once fed themselves and their communities convert to export crops and a system that relies on earning income from a worldwide commodities market with often devastating results. Debbie Barker explains.
There are huge farmer suicides now, and many of the farmers are, for example, committing suicide by swallowing the very pesticides that were supposed to bring them prosperity to their crops. What's happened again is they used to do smaller, more diverse crops growing, an example, they intercrop, have a lot of different kinds of foods and crops growing together, and that really helped to have a, set up a natural kind of pest management system. And when they switch to these, whether it be GE seeds or hybrid seeds for industrial agriculture, the requirement is you wipe out your diverse crops, you plant only one crop, and then you're more subject to blight of disease, the seed that you had that was supposed to be resistant, over years it becomes resistant. I mean, even in the U.S., farmers buy new seed every single year because the seeds will become, you know, pests will find a new way to get to that crop, so they always have to buy a new hybrid seed. Same with pesticides, you have to just keep dumping more and more pesticides or different pesticides. Soils have eroded, the topsoils in a lot of these small Indian villages now have just completely disappeared. Water systems have been totally polluted, and so that's what's leading to these farmer suicides, and we see that not only in India but around the world.
Many World Bank loan projects are co-designed by transnational corporations for the farmers of developing nations. These loan packages promise seeds, pesticides, and training. The training, oftentimes, is instruction to use much more pesticides. The loan projects offer unfair advantage to these corporations because they feature the sale of their products to the farmers. These loan packages have devastated participating farmers. During the first season or two, farmers experience an increase in yields. After that, the short-term gains very rapidly dissolve as the pesticides kill all of the insects in the farmers' fields, pests as well as the pests' natural predators. Dr. Marcia Ishii-Eideman is the director of the Pesticide Action Network's World Bank Accountability Project, working to ensure that World Bank projects respond to community concerns and comply with the bank's own social and environmental policies. Dr. Ishii-Eideman describes the pesticide treadmill that these World Bank loan packages put farmers on.
Their yields start to go down. The soil is often, the quality of the soil decreases, it hardens, soil microorganisms are killed off, and the fertility of the soil goes down. Meanwhile, the farmers are trapped in what's commonly called the pesticide treadmill. They have mounting debts because they've often acquired these pesticides through loans, and they're not able to reap the same yields that they did in the first year or two. So their income is dropping at the same time that their debts are mounting, their health is compromised, their children's health is at risk. Their animals are often also experiencing poisoning from the pesticides if they feed them plants from their fields, which they often do. And they spiral downwards into a cycle of debt and environmental and health devastation from which it's very difficult to recover.
Frances Moore LaPay has devoted her life to the study of hunger and its causes. Co-founder of the Food Policy Institute and renowned author, Frances Moore LaPay links the alleviation of hunger to the roots of democracy.
I came to see that hunger is not a scarcity of food, but ultimately a scarcity of democracy, that it's not simply a structure of government distant, done to us or for us. For democracy to be real, it has to become a way of life, that which we practice every day. And so I came to see that no one chooses to go hungry. And so therefore, if there are hungry people here in the United States or in India or in Kenya, it means that democracy has not been fulfilled. Since no one chooses to go hungry, the very existence of hunger belies democracy, because my notion of democracy means we all have voice and we all have the capacity to meet our most basic needs. If we don't have that, then what is the point of democracy? I mean, I really think that hunger is the best barometer, the best measure of the existence of democracy.
Debbie Barker talks about what we can do to make a difference.
Where you live and where you buy your food and who you buy it from makes an immediate difference. And that is one of the most powerful things that people can do, is control if they're buying organically, if they're buying from local suppliers. You are defying, if you will, a whole industrial agriculture system, and you are supporting a system that's healthy, environmentally truly sustainable, healthy, and it has a huge impact I think that's probably the most direct thing that everybody can do.
For Making Contact, I'm Diane Solomon.
For the last two decades, rice farmers in Haiti have struggled to survive. When the time comes to sell their crop each year, they find the market flooded with cheap rice from the United States. Big U.S. companies have a clear advantage over the local farmers. They have vast resources, they use high-tech methods, and enjoy government subsidies, an advantage that is supposed to be against the rules of free trade. Haiti's not allowed to use quotas or to put regulations in place that would restrict rice imports. Yolette Etienne is from Haiti and works with peasant organizations in the northern part of the island country. She spoke with Making Contact's Laura Lavati about how the World Bank model of food production doesn't work for Haiti.
Justement, du riz, c'est ton porte d'entrée, parce que je me suis dit tout à l'heure, c'est que qu'on y a l'y atteindre.
The rice that started coming into Haiti in 1986 was really the opening of the floodgates, if you will. Now we are seeing many, many basic agricultural products such as cereals, various types of wheats, peas and other things, also coming into Haiti and undermining local production. Not only do the producers in the U.S. have an advantage in terms of production, but they also have an advantage in terms of communication and transport, so they can get their goods to the most remote and isolated parts of Haiti, whereas small peasant producers in Haiti are not able to do this. So in Haiti today, we have a great deficit in terms of production, meaning that, of course, we have no food security at all. There could be solutions that arise, but right now what we're finding is that there is tremendous pressure, especially from the World Bank and the IMF, against our implementing these alternatives because they're not interested in seeing peasant production compete with free market models.
Before 1986, let's talk about the situation in Haiti and rice. Where were Haitians getting their rice before 1986, and what happened in 1986 that changed?
C'est justement gain une zone dans pays là dans département la Tibonite qui censé te cabaille tout pays à manger du riz.
There was a zone in Haiti, a region called the Artibonite, which can produce enough rice to feed the whole country. There are regions in the south and in the northwest of Haiti that could provide enough rice for Haiti to have food security. Another thing to look at is the model of consumption. In the past, rice wasn't the only carbohydrate that people were consuming. They also ate a lot of corn, millet, yams, and sweet potatoes.
Justement, avec libéralisation, c'est ça tout. Il vient affecter habitude de consommation. Du riz vient passer principal céréal.
We need to look at the whole overall impact of trade liberalization. Not only have these other forms of carbohydrate really fallen out of the diet, with rice remaining really the one that has supplanted everything else, but people have less access to purchase rice than they did in the past because it's imported. So now if you look at what people are eating and what people are putting in their bodies, they are imported things. These are the tastes and the so-called needs that have been developed, but they can't be met.
In the United States, we often hear that the free market is the answer to alleviating poverty, to bringing countries in the global south, or what's sometimes called the third world, to bringing their living standards up so that they'll be not so monetarily poor. How do you answer those who make this claim?
Jean, enfin nous tous nous connaissons, c'est que qu'on y a commerce mondial là basé en plus sur haute technologie et puis gros majorité transactions qui fait au niveau commerce mondial là, ils fait entre pays développés.
What we know is that today, most of the world commerce is based on high technology, and most of world commerce is controlled and produced by the wealthy countries. In addition to the traditional exploitation that has always existed between rich and poor countries, today we need increasingly to speak about marginalization of the poor countries. Today everyone can realize the benefit. Is this just a benefit that is helping us accept the cast-off, the waste, from the wealthy countries? Exactly, it's the waste. If you look, for example, at the case of secondhand clothes, a country is being inundated with cast-off clothes from the U.S. and other wealthy countries, which means that our own custom of seamstressing and embroidery can no longer be sustained. Same thing is true with food. When you go to the market today, what do you find? You find chicken wings, things that people in the wealthy countries don't want, that they send to our country, so we're left with the waste. So we're talking about the benefit of wealthy countries when what we're receiving are the toxic products and the unwanted products from the rich countries? So is our choice just to continue to live just as citizens of second-class status? Is that the choice we're being given? And it seems that the only way that we're able to survive is because we have a whole different status in terms of healthcare needs and the food needs that we are supposed to have access to. So we are given a whole different set of conditions through which we are meant to live. That's our choice.
How would you answer the person here who says, well, you know, used clothes, that's actually providing something that these so-called poor people didn't have otherwise, and a job in a sweatshop, well, a job in a sweatshop is better than no job. Well, you know, cheap imported rice, that's better than not having food. These are the things that people here would say to you. How do you answer them?
I think that it's a poison gift. We know that every human being has certain needs, and there are ways that these needs can be met that would allow the people to continue their humanity. We all have the ability, the need to develop our human capacity in order to meet those basic needs. I don't think that anyone should accept a world in which certain people have the ability to meet their needs, whereas other people, the vast majority, have to live off of waste, off of toxic goods, off of handouts, off of charity. What women in every country need, what men in every country need, is the ability to find dignified work, so that they can meet the needs that every human being on this planet has. In the name of globalization, they are eliminating the possibility of most people in the world to produce the resource that they need in order to survive, and the dignity they need in order to survive. That is a crime, and there's no way to justify this crime by saying, oh, but we're giving handouts. What I am saying is not that we reject solidarity. There are certain times in which some people are living in conditions that are more vulnerable than others. There are times when certain countries are living in situations that in fact are very, very difficult. For instance, such as after a natural disaster or a war. In those times, solidarity is necessary. But it cannot be a standard of living. It cannot be a norm for people to live on the basis of receiving toxic and poison assistance.
That was Yolette Etienne speaking with Making Contact's Laura Lavati. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, we'll be giving out our toll-free number at the end of this broadcast. The safety of the U.S. food supply has long been a concern of consumer groups. Now it's one of the FBI's top priorities. The U.S. government will investigate foreign foods to detect possible channels for international terrorism. According to the 2003 budget proposal from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the government is likely to funnel $97 million towards, quote, threat assessment and emergency preparedness for addressing food counterterrorism and food security issues, unquote, paying particular attention to imported and high-risk foods as vehicles for bioterrorism. But where some see a need to fund counterterrorism programs, others see a system that helps breed conditions for disease. Making Contacts, Garance Burke has more.
To listen to the FBI lately, one of the most dangerous new threats may not come from box knives or networks of scheming terrorists. It could come from your lunchbox. That's right. In February 2002, the FBI declared food security a national security issue, and the U.S. FDA requested $97 million for the next fiscal year to strike at high-risk foods before they reach us. Janice Oliver is the deputy director for the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition at the FDA.
We don't have any specific threat at the present moment, but we want to be prepared in case there should be.
Like many programs connected to the Office of Homeland Security, officials caution that making too much information available to the public could jeopardize the program's success. Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson has emphasized his concerns about food security, but the threat to the U.S. food supply remains ill-defined. The bulk of the FDA's proposed budget for counterterrorism would go to hiring 673 new inspectors who would investigate crops, take the temperature on dairy products, examine lab samples, and track down terrorist foods abroad. Janice Oliver.
Some will be doing inspections at the border, physical examinations of products that are coming in. Some will be doing inspections overseas. Some will be doing domestic inspections in the United States. And some of the people that are being hired will actually be doing testing in the laboratories. They'll be analysts. The first target the first year will be to try to double the number of field physical examinations of food imports that are coming into the country. So they're the products that are actually coming into the docks and coming into the United States.
Since many countries that produce food sold in U.S. supermarkets don't adhere to national health and safety standards, imported foods could represent a significant health risk. But Winona Howder, the director of Public Citizens Energy and Environment Program, says that the real threat to our food comes from the government's failure to enact safer standards for overall food production.
What we need to do is address the problems that we currently have in our food system, where you have huge factory farms that are basically industrialized concentration camps for animals. I mean, they're filthy, they're big, they pollute the streams, and they then lead to the kind of disease threats that have been a problem long before 9/11. Those types of operations are bad for a number of reasons. They destroy rural areas and put family farmers out of business. They create environmental problems. And they are a perfect place to come in and to tamper with food for any domestic or international terrorists. So if we would begin to clean up the way that we produce our food and not let our food policy be driven by large corporations that are most concerned about their profit, we could address a lot of the problems that are being mentioned around terrorism and our food supply.
In 1997, the USDA and FDA introduced a new set of regulations called the Hazard Analysis Critical Control Point, or HACCP, which made food companies in various sectors responsible for carrying out their own health and safety inspections and drastically reduced government inspectors' role. Against the recommendations of the General Accounting Office, the FDA is now considering making HACCP the safety standard throughout the food industry, to be used both at home and abroad. 5 years ago, members of the American Federation of Government Employees decided to sue the Secretary of Agriculture for what they saw as industry's failure to protect consumer safety. Arthur Hughes is the president of the Northeast Council of Food Inspection Locals, and he says that the meat industry's record under HACCP has been
dismal. dismal. To begin with, they don't have the history, and you know it's something that would take them years and years to do, and there would have to be some forceful oversight over this. It takes about a year to make a good inspector that you could turn loose and be comfortable with. Well, they take employees on any given day without any experience and put them on that line. They don't really know what they're looking for. And we've proven this because in some plants, our inspectors doing oversight by monitoring these will pick up cancerous conditions, contamination, all of these things that these people miss. And so, you know, it's like the fox guarding the hen house.
Aside from the problems associated with privatizing food inspection, some scientists say that the U.S. public could have avoided potential threats to its food supply if it were not for the U.S. government's efforts to develop biological weapons for use against other countries. Dr. Mark Wheelis is a microbiologist at the University of California, Davis, and a member of the Federation of American Scientists Working Group on Biological Weapons. He says that the biggest agro-terrorist menace comes from U.S. government programs to develop biological weapons for use against foreign crops. Wheelis has been watching a pilot program to use fungal pathogens to destroy drug crops in Afghanistan and in the Andean region.
The United States is working very hard to try to discourage and deter other governments and terrorist groups from acquiring biological and chemical weapons capability, and for us to be in our own laboratories to be developing those capabilities is at least open to the perception of hypocrisy. I'm also concerned that if the United States were to actually move towards implementing any of these programs, if we actually used fungal pathogens to attack poppy fields in Afghanistan, or if we started, even with the assistance of, say, the Colombian government, to spray coca plantations with fungal spores, that the very well-funded and very capable criminal organizations that are involved in drug trafficking might well decide, if they're going to do that to our coca plants, why don't we introduce foot and mouth disease into the U.S., or why don't we introduce late blight of potato or soybean rust or something like that. So I think the potential for these programs to invite retaliation in kind is significant, and I think the implications for international arms control and the potential lowering the bar for agricultural bioterrorism would be quite counterproductive.
For Making Contact, I'm Garance Burke.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at threats to food security. Thanks for listening. And special thanks this week to Beverly Bell for translation, Pilar Gonzalez for voiceover assistance, and Damian Irizarry for production assistance. Philip Babbage is our managing producer, Laura Levati, managing director, Peggy Law, executive director, Stephanie Welch, co-producer, administrative coordinator, Rosalyn Fay, women's desk director, Lisa Rudman, senior advisor, Norman Solomon, national producer, David Barsamian, and I'm your host and co-producer, Shireen Marisol Meraji. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, or if you would like to reach any of our guests, call the National Radio Project at 1-800-529-5736. Call that same number for tapes and transcripts. That's 800-529-5736. You can also go to our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time.